Welcome to the Nine Finger Chronicles podcast, brought to you by Exodus Trail Cameras, the number one podcast for bow hunting product information and hunting stories from across the nation. And now, here's your nine-fingered host, Dan Johnson.
Three, two, one, and it is Thursday. Thank you very much for tuning in. Hopefully everybody's having a great week. I'm pretty excited. I got Thursday to work and a half a day on Friday. I think I'm going to be taking some PTO so I can get a head start on the staycation fishing trip. Pretty excited for that. Weather's supposed to be absolutely awesome, and the father-in-law tells me that the fish are biting really good. And hopefully that continues through the rest of this week and into this weekend. Pretty excited about that. It's Mother's Day weekend, so be sure to buy your wife or your baby mama a gift, because moms are important, and your mom or your stepmom, whoever. Be sure to buy them some flowers or some chocolates, or if they're into bow hunting gear, buy them some broadheads or whatever, you know. That would be a pretty kick-ass Mother's Day gift if, in fact, your mother loved bow hunting, or your wife or whatever. Anyway, today's podcast is kind of another extension of a podcast that we did a while back, and the title of that podcast was called Shop Talk. And today we talk with another bow tech from a different bow shop. And today, David Engel from Ames, Iowa, talks about, man, just a variety of stuff. We cover releases, we cover form, we cover tuning, and we get in really deep into the tuning aspect of it. We even start talking about, you know, how to twist the strings to adjust cam timing. We talk about cam shims. We talk about a variety of things that may help you just become a better overall archer. And for bow hunting, that's a big thing. So there's that. Now, before we get into today's podcast, we talked with a gentleman, Todd Minogue, I think is how you pronounce his name. Todd Minogue, I'm not going to work here anymore. It's actually Todd Mongey. And Todd talks to us a little bit about why he likes his Exodus trail cameras.
Sure. I bought a Exodus camera in October and was very excited to use it. I've got a lease that's 4.5 hours away in southwest Wisconsin. So obviously I'm not going to drive down there a couple times a week just to check cameras. And I was looking for something that was dependable, and it just lived up to the name, and was very excited about just everything that Exodus was touted to be. Got down after the camera had been up probably a couple weekends, and found that, as usual, per everybody that's had a trail camera, no pictures were taken for that time. Little bit frustrating. Probably figured it was user error, but in reading the Exodus website, there was a number, said text to this number, and somebody from our company will get a hold of you Saturday afternoon, late October. Thinking, okay, well, nobody's going to call me back till Monday. But anyway, I did text that number, and within an hour, I had a phone call back, and it was one of the owners. I don't remember which one, but was really gracious. Talked me through, you know, what happened, what was going on, and you know, just gave me some pointers, kind of walked me through it. I wasn't in the field at the time when he called me, but I did what he said to do. It was a formatting issue on my end. I probably just didn't hit the right number of buttons. But the fact that on a Saturday in October, you've got the owner of the company calling you, I'm sure that as avid deer hunters, he wanted to be in the deer stand as much as I did. It just says a lot about the company that they're willing to call somebody and work through whatever problems they could have. And that says a lot to me. And as a business owner myself, I just know that customers depend on, they're depending on a company when they buy some stuff. So just the fact that they can do that, is that just says a lot for them.
All right. If you guys want to find out more information about Exodus trail cameras. By now, it should be ingrained in your head. Go to ExodusOutdoorGear.com. And when you do decide to purchase one of their trail cameras, be sure to enter the code 9Fingers. That's the number 9 followed by the word fingers, and you will receive $20 off of your trail camera purchase. So there's that. Now let's get into today's hunter profile. It's not a hunter profile. What am I doing? It's a shop talk episode. I guess that's just, I don't know why I did that. Anyway, shop talk episode with David Engel. Mr. David Engel, how are you doing today?
Good. I'm doing great. How are you, Dan?
I can't complain. We had a really good, we had a good storm system come through Iowa. Let's see, southeast Iowa today. And all this, social media was blown up with all these pictures of tornadoes. And that tornado went really close by the farm that I hunt. And so I called the landowner and I was just like, everything okay down there? And she had no clue what was going on. And she's like, I didn't see any tornado. I was doing chores and not paying attention. And meanwhile, there's a tornado within a mile of her house.
Yeah, that's pretty crazy.
So I called her up and she was okay. It doesn't seem like there's any damage on the farm, and the deer live to tell, or live for another day. But before we get, today we're going to talk just probably about a variety of stuff. You work in an archery shop and you are currently a bow tech for that archery shop, and you've been setting up your friends' bows and you've been setting up all types of equipment for your friends and family for 4 or 5 years now. And we're going to get into all of this archery portion. We're going to talk about releases and form and rests and sights and stabilizers. And we're going to talk about archery part of bow hunting tonight. But before we get into all that, from a hunting standpoint, how was your 2016 season?
Pretty depressing, if I'm being honest. I mean, being a student, it's a little bit difficult to get as much time as you want in the woods, obviously. With classes and everything, but buck tag remained in the pocket the whole year. Was fortunate enough to fill a doe tag.
Nice.
But overall, I mean, it went all right. Coming in, not really expecting to be able to put a whole lot of time in the stand. So, yeah. You know, can't complain too much.
Right. So as a student, what are you going to school for?
Right now I'm studying in the College of Ag and Life Sciences.
Okay.
As kind of a general ag major at Iowa State.
Okay.
You know, studying all aspects of agronomy and animal science, stuff like that.
Gotcha. So where do you see yourself going after college? What, like, if you had a dream job, what's your dream job?
Dream job? You know, I've kind of been looking into custom planting food plots kind of around the area in Iowa. Maybe down in Missouri, Nebraska, Minnesota, Wisconsin, kind of along there. Okay. Whether that started as part-time or full-time and, you know, working somewhere else. Yeah, something like that. It's kind of what I'm looking at.
Now let's go back to the real world for a second. Right out of college, what kind of jobs does that degree get you?
With the ag degree, I mean, that's pretty broad, especially living in the state of Iowa. You could do anything as far as being a banker for farmers, you know, all the way up to being a farmer yourself.
Yep.
A lot of guys are going into it, working for their family on the family farm and stuff, and just looking to gain a little bit of knowledge to go back and maybe help that out. Anyone that knows farming right now and prices knows that, you know, there's not a whole lot of money in it. So I've been looking to be as efficient as they can, and sending your kids to college to kind of, you know, get a different look on stuff. Definitely something worth looking into.
Yeah. So do you come from a farming family then?
Not directly. I helped out for farmer growing up and stuff. And my family bought over some land from great grandpa, and he used to farm it back in the day, but since then we're a generation removed from directly family farming. Okay. We still raise a little bit of grain sorghum ourselves, but you know, not directly related to corn soybean rotations, which most people are familiar with driving around anywhere in the Midwest.
Gotcha. What part of the state are you from?
Just north of Des Moines, so right in the middle.
Yep. All right. So is there good deer hunting there, or do you travel a little bit further for to bow hunt?
No, mostly it's hunting family's ground. Up in Ames, there's quite a bit of public ground not too far from here is what I mainly hunted this year, and figured out the challenges of that, and you know, competing for access and everything. And one thing I learned is never think that you see a good spot, don't think that there's not 10 other people that have walked by there and think the same thing.
Right. So is that public ground around you get pounded pretty hard then?
Oh yeah, especially with the college in the Midwest, where there's a lot of people that hunt there, and pretty much no one has their own private ground there. And I mean, private ground's pretty hard to get access to in Iowa. So I mean, the one tract of public ground we have there gets hammered pretty hard by students and anyone hanging around the area that doesn't have access to private ground. And in the area, you know, it's pretty flat once you get north of Des Moines.
Right.
Not real heavily wooded. So the areas that are get hounded pretty heavy.
Okay. Cool. So kind of a shitty season then, huh?
Yeah. Yeah, you can say that.
Did you get out turkey hunting at all?
I actually went to Nebraska about a month ago. Me and a couple buddies went out there. Didn't end up punching a tag, but we saw tons of birds and just kind of got a different feel of hunting than just in central Iowa.
Right.
But it was fun.
Nice. All right. So you work at a bow shop, right?
Yep.
All right. Why don't you go ahead and shout out the name of the bow shop? Get this guy some free press.
Yeah. I work at a Jack's Outdoor Gear in Ames, Iowa. We have a full service archery shop, a 20-yard indoor range. And we also sell a number of outdoor supplies from guns, camping gear, athletic gear, stuff like that. And it is a chain store. We're the only one in Iowa. The rest of our stores are out in Colorado, though. But we do have a full service archery shop there. So, anything archery related, we can handle it.
Okay. Now, how old are you right now?
21 years old.
21 years old. Okay. So, and you've been working at that store for a year and a half, roughly, right?
Yep. I started when I moved up to Ames, which is January of 2016, right around the first of the years when I started there.
Okay. And before that, before working at this bow shop, how many years... Like, when did you start tinkering with bows on your own?
Probably started messing around with my bow when I was about 16, 17 years old, back in high school. Would go kind of hang around the local archery shop in Des Moines and picked up a lot of information from guys down there, started using equipment and tinkering with my own bow, figuring out what, a twist in the cable here does to my timing here, and I mean there's a lot of guys along the way that help you out, and that's a good thing about the archer community is everyone's willing to help out a new guy, it seems like.
Right. Okay. So I think the first thing that I want to talk about is something that you just mentioned, and we'll kind of go all over the place with this conversation, but the goal is to try to have share some of your knowledge from working at a bow shop with the listeners of this podcast. Now, I want to talk about this adding twists, taking twists out of the string, and how that affects the bow. Because I've heard people talk about it, and to be honest with you, I really am not sure what it actually does. So can you explain what, maybe why you would want to take a twist out or put a twist in your, you know, in your cable?
Yeah, I'll kind of take an aspect as far as cam timing. Your cables are what's going to control your timing. Say you got a top cam that's hitting a little bit ahead of your bottom cam, and it's kind of giving you some weird arrow flight. The biggest way you can see that's happening is either put it in a draw or draw board, and that'll, I mean, it's got a crank on it that'll draw your bow back for you. So you can see what your cams are doing as you pull that back. Either do that or have a buddy watch you draw your bow back, and you'll be able to tell if one of your cams is hitting your cable before the other. A lot of times bows like to tune with the cam sitting dead even. So say your top cam sitting a little bit ahead, toss your bow in a bow press, and you're going to have a control cable which comes down to your bottom cam, and you'll want to put a twist into that, take it back out, and hopefully that advances your bottom cam enough to where they're going to be hitting about the same. And you know, obviously vice versa for, you know, say your top cam's behind, throw a twist in the top.
Right. So is that how you fix cams not being in sync with each other?
Yeah, on 99% of both. There is, a few other ways, like Elite and Prime are kind of unique with how they utilize a limb stop versus a cable stop.
Right.
So on each cam, you can adjust where that limb stop sits. So if you don't have access to a bow press at the time, kind of the easy fix is moving that limb stop to where it's hitting the same as the other cam versus putting it in a press and putting twists in your cable.
Okay. So with a bow that has a limb stop, let's say they're, because limb stops are on the cam, correct?
Correct, yeah.
Right. So, and then there's little holes to adjust where that is. Now, is there, do you want to adjust the limb stop, or do you want to adjust the string and put twists in it for the best accuracy? Is there one way that's better than the other?
Not necessarily. I mean, it's going to boil down to your particular bow. Say like I shot my prime this year for turkey season, and the way I shot that was and on the cams you can adjusting those limb stops is going to change your let off percentage. And for hunting I like to have a little bit higher let off. So those cams you're able to get up to 85% let off, and that's with your limb stops all the way back at your cam.
Okay.
So they're going to utilize the longest draw length possible, which gives you the more let off.
Okay.
So moving those around is going to change your let off a little bit. So I like to, on my prime anyways, I would slide them all the way back, and if the cams were out of sync from there, I would start putting twists into my cable.
All right. Now, what about bows that don't have limb stops? Is that just,
yeah, so
it goes right back to trying to put twists in the string?
Right, yeah, because most bows that have cable stops, you're not going to be able to slide that peg around.
Right.
So it's all going to be twisting your cables to get it all synchronized up. And okay. Some bows, like I've had a few Hoyts that don't like to be tuned with them hitting exactly the same. Like I had a Nitrim Turbo and that tuned best with my top cam hitting just a hair in front of my bottom cam. And I had a Spider Turbo that like the bottom cam hitting a little bit ahead. And my Defiant, I shot that, both cams hitting exactly the same. So it varies bow to bow, depending on which specific model, draw length, cam, and everything you have.
So listening to you say that makes me think of some engineering questions, and I don't know whether you can answer this or not, but for a bow that is has dual cams, I would assume that if during your draw, right, you want both the top and the bottom cam doing the same exact thing so that when you release at the same exact time, they are firing, you know, that arrow at the most efficient speed possible, right?
Right, and that's pretty much true for, you know, kind of like a binary cam system where the cams are shaped exactly the same, right. Whether it be top, bottom. You know, a lot of times, even the left and right-handed models, their cams are almost identical.
Right.
And those ones like to utilize the cams hitting exactly the same time. Whereas you take something like a Hoyt, where the cams are shaped a little bit different and the mods are shaped a little bit different on top and bottom, they okay. might like to tune a little bit funky versus, you know, something with a binary cam system.
Gotcha. So on the Hoyts that you mentioned where the top and bottom were a little off as far as timing is concerned, those cams were different. They weren't the exact same, right?
Correct, yeah.
Okay. All right, cool. All right, so then, you know, what happens if you have some problem, you know, you're trying to tune your bow. First off, I got all these ideas rolling in my head, so I'm starting to stutter, right? So I got to do a better job of staying calm and just asking the questions. All right. So let's say you're adjusting you put a couple twists in, you're trying to get your cams to fire at the same time and it's not working and you're still having issues with your arrow being sporadic, and that's given that your rest is set up where it needs to be, right? So we've still identified that it is a timing issue. What else can a guy do to get those cams to fire at the same time, or you can get your bow better tuned?
Yeah, so there's a couple different things. So I like to start out, whenever I'm tuning a bow, I'll start out with the cams synchronized exactly, you know, hitting dead nuts at the same time. I'll start out with my arrow 90 degrees from the string, running through the middle of the burger button hole. And kind of as a general then after that, I'll move to, paper tuning, after, draw length in spec, brace height, axle, all that's in spec. And, say cams are synced and we're still getting weird tears. A lot of times that's something you can, take out with yoke tuning. If you've got it, like in a Hoyt, your top cam's going to have a yoke cable, where it kind of splits off. It connects on the outside of your axles on the cam there. And okay. You can twist either side of those is going to control your arrow flight a little bit, kind of fine-tuning your tears through paper. And that's one way you can do that. Another thing is like I said, kind of messing around with putting your top cam ahead of your bottom cam. Kind of that sort of thing. Okay. Then another thing you can do, like on Elites, Matthews, Primes, you can shim out your cams, which is kind of like yoke tuning. It's tuning the way your cam leans at full draw. That requires taking your bow into a press, taking your strings and cables off, sliding your cam out. Then there's little spacers inside of there. That are all different thicknesses and stuff. Right. So you can swap those around to get your cam leaning a different way, and sometimes that'll take care of it. Like even on the Hoyts, 2016, their Defiant line, when it first came out, their bottom cam was having some of the models were having issues where it would lean on your draw cycle and hit the cable. But with a lot of our bows that were doing that in the shop, we would just take that out and swap the spacers around, which gave you a little more clearance there, and kind of took that out of play, which would have led to cable wear down the line, which could be potentially hazardous, especially if you're out in the field and you got a worn cable that severs and now your bow is out of use or out of commission.
All right. So I'm the guy, right, who I buy a bow, I get my sight, I get my rest, I get my arrows, and I take it to the shop to do, right? I don't have a bow press. Mm-hmm. I don't do a lot of my own work. I take it to a bow tech and have them do that work. You mentioned something about yokes. And that's one thing that we haven't talked a lot about on this podcast. What is a yoke? What does it do? And how does that particular part affect accuracy?
Yeah. So your yoke is going to be on something like a Hoyt or like a Bowtech, something like that, that uses a yoke cable where it connects to the axle outside of your limbs. On your top cam on like a Hoyt or on like a Bowtech, it'll be on both sides. And that controls your cam lean, whether it be at static or full draw. And twisting those will affect how that sits at full draw, which will affect how your arrow comes off in small increments anyways. So if you're getting a weird tear and, your center shot's in spec, everything's in spec, but you're getting a little bit of cam lean, a lot of times yoke tuning, that's what's going to be taking that little tear out or that little imperfection in your arrow flight.
So not every bow has a yoke on it, right?
Right, yeah. Like okay. Some of the new Matthews, like the Halons, no cams, stuff like that, don't have yokes. Let's see, Elites don't. Primes don't. They all use a kind of like a, like Prime and Elite are binary, versus, Hoyt's cam and a half, stuff like that.
Okay. Okay. So now you also mentioned something about cam lean. What is cam lean more specifically?
Yeah, so cam lean is going to be the relationship of how your cam sits compared to the perfect up and down of your string. And a lot how I do this is I'll take an arrow and lay it flat against my cam, so it's running right up and down my string. And right. If the arrow crosses over your string anywhere, that's going to show your cam lean.
Okay. All right.
Yeah, so I mean that controls a little bit of left and right, and you'll see this in your tears.
So, if your cams aren't perfectly centered, to me, I would assume that when you get your bow, it should be made to not have cam lean, right?
Yeah. A lot of times it'll come preset straight up and down, and there's certain cases maybe it's a quality control issue or something didn't get set exactly right or string stretched in the box. If it was really hot during shipping and your strings or cable stretched a little bit and it'll be off, that you need to take it out. But, nine times out of 10, it'll come straight up and down.
Gotcha. All right. Then if it's not, and you mentioned something about shims, right? You got to take the entire cam off and put little washers or what are those? What's a bow or a cam shim?
Yep, they're pretty much little polymer washers or spacers that sit in between your cam and your limb, and they sit around your axle.
Okay, so that to me seems like some pretty technical, very detailed tuning things. Are Is all that stuff necessary if you want to be, I guess, just accurate? And I'm not talking about professional archer accurate. I'm talking about 30 yards from a tree stand accurate.
I would say no, it wouldn't be necessary. Just for your average bow hunter that wants to go out and be able to, you know, nail a pie plate at 30, 40 yards, something like that. You know, messing with shims is probably getting a little too in-depth for those purposes.
Right. But if your bow is not accurate in some of these aspects, you know, whether it's camling or your cams aren't firing at the same time or, you know, some of the other things that we mentioned, your bow is less efficient, meaning it could be loud, right? Or it could be, what's the word I'm looking for? It could be loud and you could be losing power, correct?
Yeah, in some cases, yeah, you could be.
All right. So then, okay, so that pretty much takes care of the draw cycle. Is there anything else as far as cams or limbs or string that a guy needs to be looking at if he wants to get more detailed about his draw cycle and accuracy?
Yeah, actually, the strings and cable set, it's what we've been talking about this whole time, and a really nice quality set of custom strings can go a long way. So like once you get everything set, a stock string and set or stock string and cable might stretch a little bit, you know, being in and out of the elements, heat, cold. A lot of times guys will leave it in their car, which can play with the strings and cable, stretching it, and your cams will come out of tune or you're out of synchronization, something like that. And a nice set of custom string and cables can go a long way as far as being more consistent and, firing the same every time.
Right. So the strings that come on a bow, you know, obviously a company has to try to make money and, they can't put the highest dollar string on their bow, you know, that, I don't know, as far, I guess the bow string, do they sacrifice there as far as price is concerned? I mean, I would think that as a general consumer, right, I would assume that it's the best string on the market. I mean, a guy doesn't buy a Ferrari and then change the rims out on it most of the time anyway.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, the sets that are coming nowadays are better than they were 3 or 4 years ago, which were better than they were 10 years ago.
Right.
Now, yeah, I hear stories of guys that had, you know, like a Hoyt 10, 15 years ago, and the strings and cables that came on it, they were scared to pull it back just because they looked like they were in that bad a shape. But anymore, they're not too bad. They definitely don't put as much time and effort into their strings and cables as they do, like, obviously their bows and machining and making sure everything like that's fine. Their
right.
Their strings and cables are kind of an afterthought, it seems like. Okay. But they're definitely not as bad as they used to be. I still think a custom set, whether that be something that a shop makes or you order from a big company like Winner's Choice, they're just going to put a little more detail into it than a bow manufacturer would be.
Right. So what do I get? Let's say I decide to put a set of custom strings on my bow. What about a set of custom strings makes my bow operate better at a higher efficiency?
Yeah, so most of them are coming pre-stretched. So that means once they're on your bow, they're going to be, I guess, how do I word this? They're going to be
used in a way?
Not necessarily used, but there's not going to be as big of a break-in period to them. Okay. Whereas you take something that's not stretched, you're going to put them on there, and it's going to take a number of shots to get the fibers where they need to be in their top performing shape. Every string and cable set's going to have a minor break-in period. The ones that are more pre-stretched and they take more time building them, the break-in period is going to be less, and then they're once they're in that break or after that break-in period, they're going to hold that form a little bit better than say a stock string cable set or something that was of lesser quality that you put on there. Maybe your cams will come out of time, something like that.
All right. So then does a custom set of strings also, I mean, will that do anything to increase your speed, aero speed?
You can, depending on the type of material they put on there. A lot of companies anymore, they're putting BCY-X material or BCY-452 material, which is really diving, kind of deep into tuning and that kind of aspect that, most target archers are looking into, and maybe not necessarily your average bow hunter wants to dive that deep into it. But like different fibers are going to give you different speeds. Some are going to be more forgiving. Some are going to be more consistent than others. But anymore, most of the fibers are going to be pretty high quality that they're throwing in custom sets or stock sets.
All right. Anything else about strings or cables or cams or whatever?
The coolest thing you can do with a new set of strings and cables is change the color up on your bow too.
Just to make it look cool.
Yeah, that's what I'd say most people are changing them for. As far as like a hunting aspect, they just want that, a different color look on their bow.
Yeah. I gotcha. I thought about that. This year I have a gearhead bow and it's black. I got a ripcord arrow rest. It's all black. I think right now I'm going to go with an HHA sight. That's for the most part all black other than, some green on it. And I'm probably going to go with a very small stabilizer. I may not need it after it's all set up, but if I do, it's going to be all black. But I thought it'd be cool to get a red string on that bow. I think that would kind of be cool.
Yeah, I mean, that kind of seems like the popular color to go with on a black bow is either accent that with like all red or red and black twist, something like that. You can, you get most sets, you get two color options on there, so you can throw whatever you want.
Cool. All right. So there's that. Now, you mentioned to me, you're like, these next two kind of topics, they go hand in hand, right? You got your releases and your form, right? And in a way they kind of go hand in hand. And you told me, hey man, I could sit here and talk about releases and form for an hour each. So we don't have an hour to do that, but I do want to touch on releases because you mentioned that we had a guest on a while ago who talked briefly about releases, and you mentioned that you had something that maybe you would like to add to that conversation.
Yeah, he briefly touched on back tension releases and anti-punch releases that are helping guys that are struggling with target panic. Whether that be on paper targets, 3D targets, or even, they got buck fever in the woods and they just can't get their pin on it. And I've actually been shooting the new release that John Dudley came out with called the Knock-On Silverback, and it's a completely tension-activated release, so there's no trigger on it whatsoever. So it kind of gets people away from punching the trigger, which is going to help you hold your pin steady, because with those the way it works is once you're at full draw, you're pulling with your back muscles and your shoulder muscles, which sets off the release at a preset poundage over your holding weight. So the only way to hit the target is if you're holding that pin on there, which helps guys if they've got trouble and they're freezing below the target where they can't get their pin to come up, something in their brain's telling them they don't want to cover up that target with their pin, whether they just want to know that target's there. Or, I mean, a lot of the times it's 100% subconscious and you don't know why you're doing it, but you just can't get that pin on there. But that tension activated release is trying to help people hit the target, because there's no way to hit the target if you're not holding your pin on it.
So how does that specific release work, right? Is how do you, for example, I got a little sheet when I got my gearhead bow, right? And it had the guy who tested it, and he did three different draws on that bow, measured the poundage. And it was like 72.1, 72.4, 72.6 or something, or three or something like that. Right. So it was all really close from a, you know, a 10th of a pound type of, you know, difference. And the average of it was 72.2 pounds, I think it was. And how do you then take that release and say, okay, obviously the max draw on that is 72.2. How do you change your release to go off at 73?
So the way it works is it's actually going to come into play with your holding weight, not necessarily your draw weight. So when you're drawing that release, there's a safety on it, which is located where like a normal thumb trigger would be. So when you're drawing that, you hold down your thumb trigger. And then when you're at full draw and you're kind of settled into where you want to be, you got your anchor point settled, pin floating over the target, looking through your peep, you let off of that safety. And that's when you start pulling and pulling and pulling, and then it'll go off. And how you set that is there's a little spring inside of there, and you either twist that spring down or loosen it up to where you want that release to go off at. And it'll take a little bit of playing around with it with your specific bow, especially if you don't have a bow scale handy that you can look and see exactly what your holding weight is. And then you can, so how I did mine is anyways, when I took it out of the package and it let off that safety at full draw, it went right away without me pulling it. So that tells me I need to move the release weight up a little bit. I kind of like it between 3 and 4 pounds above my holding weight, so I can't just quickly snap and shoot it, which would be kind of like punching the trigger. I kind of have to work it, pulling it, and keep my form and keep my pin floating over the target versus, kind of snap shooting it like you would with any sort of trigger release.
Okay. And that is specifically designed for target panic, or it helps with target panic?
Well, it is kind of designed to help the guys that are suffering from it to get their kind of focus more on their form and holding versus aiming and squeezing that trigger as soon as your pin comes across that target. Because with those, you're going to have to spend a little more time at full draw watching that pin float. And so you can't exactly punch it as soon as your pin comes across the target, which is a lot of times called drive-by shooting. A lot of guys, as soon as that pin covers up the outer edge of the target, they want to reach at that release and punch it. So the arrow goes off. They don't have to sit anymore at full draw. They're just not comfortable holding that pin over that target.
Right, right. I think I do that a lot. I think I get into less of a dead stop on my form, but I'm always moving a little bit, whether I'm coming down on the target or I'm coming up on the target, my location where I'm trying to, and I think that's part, I have a little bit of target panic as well, but I think that's part of some of my inaccuracy problems.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And a big way you can kind of bring out the target panic is go take a blank bail target, nothing, no circles on it or whatever. And just kind of watch how your pin's floating. And if you want to kind of, even with the middle of that target, as soon as your pin gets to the middle of that target, if you still want to kind of punch at it and grab at it, I mean, that's kind of one of the indicators of target panic. And you kind of got to sit there and work at it.
Right. And what specifically do you work at? What are you trying to accomplish?
The goal with that is to get an unanticipated shot off, so you're not flinching at the target. And right. I can kind of relate that to shooting a gun. So you take like a gun that's magazine fed, and you throw three bullets in there. You shoot your first one, shoot your second one, shoot your third one. And say you didn't know there's only three in there, and you go to shoot your fourth one and kind of lean into it, flinch at the shot. That's kind of the same thing what you would be doing with pulling the trigger on the bow. Because with that rifle, you're, even though you might not notice it when you're shooting, you're still flinching at it. And then you can see that when you're firing a blank chamber, kind of about the same thing as punching the trigger on a bow.
Right. So I currently shoot a wrist release, right? And I was talking with a guy who was tuning his bow this past week on Friday, and he said that typically guys, they go from a wrist trigger release to a thumb release, then to a back tension release. Is there a need for a thumb release, or if guys are looking to make a transition, should they just, because he told me skip the thumb release and go straight to the back tension release?
Yeah, that would be my personal recommendation. I feel like the back tension release is an awesome training aid that you can use that in conjunction with, say, a thumb trigger or a wrist rocket, wrist release. And let me kind of go back and forth between the two. Like with my shooting, I'll start out with my knock on silverback, the back tension release. And I'll shoot a couple of rounds with that just to kind of, make sure my form's still intact. I'm not doing anything. Then I'll move to my thumb release, which is, I'm shooting the knock to it from knock on and carded right now. And those two are kind of made to go hand in hand. The only thing you got to worry about going between a back tension release and an index finger release is your anchor points are going to change depending on the release slightly,
right?
Which can lead to your peep sight being a little off or minor accuracy issues as far as being up or down a little ways.
Okay. So where do those, I guess, average typical anchor points, where are those for a wrist release, a thumb release, and then a back tension release?
Yeah, so on any bow, any release, you're trying to get that string to come across the tip of your nose. And then a lot of times, depending on the axle of your bow, that's coming across the corner of your mouth with a hunting bow. That's a little bit shorter axle versus the target bow is going to come a little in front of the corner of your mouth. And how you get that a lot of times with your hand, say, let's take a handheld release, like a back tension or a thumb trigger. And where you're anchoring is your index finger and your middle finger are going to kind of create a V on that handle there. And you're going to tuck your index finger underneath your jawline, and then your middle finger is going to go above. So kind of your jawbone splitting in between your fingers. Whereas with an index finger release, you take your knuckle of your index finger, your trigger finger, that's going to fit right at the base of your earlobe. And then hopefully the goal is to have your release point where your caliper or back tension release hooks to your D loop in the same spot between the two if you're switching back and forth. And whether your knuckle be at the corner of your ear or your index finger and middle finger split the jaw, it should be roughly about the same.
Okay. So what happens if you don't have a right index finger?
Ooh, that's a tricky one. I haven't come across that one yet.
Do I just give up on bow hunting? Go to crossbows?
Yeah, no, I wouldn't go that far.
All right. So do you hunt with your back tension release then?
No, I hunt with my thumb trigger, the knock to it right now.
Okay.
Which, I mean, some guys do hunt with a back tension. It's just, the reason I don't is, number one, I like to clip my release on the string of my bow, and the thumb trigger one's going to be completely enclosed so it can't fall off, whereas the back tension one is going to be, there's a little bit of opening on there so it can slide off and fall around and stuff. Another reason is I have had a couple instances where I was practicing and just not thinking. I didn't put my thumb on that safety, drawn back, and the arrow just skipped down range because I didn't get to full draw before it went off, obviously. I just kind of take the bonehead arrows out of play when I'm hunting because they're going to happen.
Right. So from a accuracy standpoint and how you use releases in your archery game bag, do most guys use a back tension release just for practice to get rid of target panic and then go to the thumb or the wrist for hunting scenarios?
Yeah, but it seems like that's what most guys are doing. They're getting that right form and right feeling down with that back tension release. And then once they have that down and they're feeling confident with their form, they'll start to practice with that index finger thumb release. And then ultimately that's going to be what they're taking into the field with them.
Okay. Now, how does a guy know that he has the right release for him? I mean, because obviously different people feel more, you know, feel comfortable with different things, and that's just life in general. But how does a guy know he has the right release?
That's all going to come down to your preference and your comfort. If the handle is too big on your release and you're feeling, you know, kind of awkward at full draw and you can't really get comfortable, you're not going to have a good shot every time. Versus, say you're just comfortable with your wrist release and having your fingers hang off the side and just resting that, just your index finger on there, and that's what you're comfortable with, and you're gonna shoot better at that than, okay, you know, something you don't feel comfortable with.
Gotcha. Now, any other tips or tricks or things you want to talk about releases?
I guess I would say just try as many as you can. Get your hands on as many as you can. Another thing you want to look out for is releases that have trigger travel. Whether that be thumb or index finger releases, there's some out there that have trigger travel and you're not going to be able to adjust that out. And I would just say steer clear of that. And when you're setting up a bow, a release isn't the area you want to cheap out on, as far as, you know, setting up someone that isn't too familiar with it. I'd say go more expensive on your release and then sacrifice a little bit of money somewhere else.
Okay. And what is, you mentioned trigger travel. What is that? How do I know that my release has trigger travel and why is it bad?
Yeah, if you can take your release and hook it on your bowstring and just put a little bit of tension on that, if you slowly pull your trigger and you can see that moving before it goes off, that's when you know you have some trigger travel. And what that leads to is anticipating the shot, because you, whether you know it or not, you're going to start to anticipate where that release eventually lets go if you got trigger travel on that. So that'll lead to punching the trigger a little bit more, just because you can kind of force yourself to hang on that edge, and then when your pin floats across the target, you'll want to reach at that and just set it off right then, versus going through your form and everything and doing the steps and letting that release come naturally.
So the goal is to have a surprise release, right?
Correct, yeah.
Okay. All right. Releases. Anything else you want to touch on releases?
No, I think that's about it. Covered everything.
Okay. So the next bullet list that we discussed before we started recording was form, right? I know I have bad form, and I had a conversation, this was a long time ago, with Levi Morgan, and obviously he's one of the best archers from a compound standpoint in the world. And he told me that you can be good at archery and still have bad form if you practice bad form every day, right? If you're consistent with your bad form, you can still have really good accuracy.
Yeah. Now, oh yeah. 100%.
Yeah. So my question is, how important is form? I mean, what does, obviously it's good, but should you try to always perfect your form, or should you just be, you know, if you're doing something consistent over and over and over again, that's okay.
I would say go for the consistency. And I like to relate this to anyone that golfs and has worked on their golf swing can attest to, you know, not trying to have it 100% perfect, like, you know, not emulating Tiger Woods or not emulating a specific professional golfer, because their swing works for them, whereas that same swing might not work for your body type. Whereas you see someone like Levi shooting a certain way and you try to shoot exactly like him, and you're just not getting the performance out of it as you were with how you naturally shoot your bow, I would say just go for what feels comfortable and what you can repeat time after time and make a consistent shot every time.
Okay. So you work in a bow shop, right? And you see a lot of guys come in and out, and you get to see a lot of people draw back and have probably pretty shitty form. What are some of the biggest form no-nos? I mean, if like you said here, consistency is the most important, but if I wanted to work on my form, what are some big red flags that I need to look out for or things I need to work on?
I mean, a lot of the things I see in an archery shop, one, someone bringing in a bow that isn't fit up or set up exactly for them, whether they're shooting a little bit too long, too short a draw length, which can be just as bad as anything, or someone trying to draw too much weight, where they put a little bit too much stress on their muscles and their joints, and they're not able to, you know, either hold as steady or shoot as long. And a lot of times you'll see that when guys are drawing and they kind of got to lean back and point their bow up and stuff like that. So, I mean, those two things are some of the biggest no-nos. Another one is grip. And there's, I mean, you ask 10 guys about grip and, you know, a lot of times you'll get 10 different answers, how you should put your fingers, which way you should twist your wrist, where the grip should be lining up with your palm, lifeline, thumb, all that kind of thing. But, I mean, most of the time with grip, it's going to be getting in that same position every time and not really gripping that bow handle, just to take as much torque out of the shot as you can, so you're not really twisting that riser when that arrow goes off and throwing any weird inconsistencies on your arrow flight.
Okay. So specifically on the grip, creating torque, you really don't want – the grip is not – for archery purposes, a grip, we shouldn't grip our grip, if that makes sense, right?
Right, yeah.
So the only thing you really want to do is rest it on your palm or right in between your thumb and index finger, right?
Yeah, and it should be kind of more towards the fat of your thumb is where it's gonna end up, versus kind of down the middle of your palm. You kind of want to stay to the... depending on how you're looking at it, on your thumb side of your lifeline down the middle of your palm is kind of a good general starting point.
Okay. And that's a general place to, you know, as far as good form is concerned, that's where you want to have it every single time.
Yep. I mean, as long as you're putting your grip down the same part of your hand every single time, you're doing better than most guys are.
Okay. Now, I have a problem, I think, with torque only because every once in a while I notice my strings not necessarily lining up with my cams on full draw, right? I always kind of pull my head back. I look at just to see if I'm doing it right. And then I always have to adjust a little bit, right? And mm-hmm. I try to do that over and over and over again. Does that mean it's form, or are you able to change your grip out to, I guess, fix some of those problems?
As far as changing to...
Like bettering your form. If you change your grip, will you have better form?
Yeah, I mean, that's a big way to... I mean, if you look up at your cams and you see your string's kind of coming off at an angle, but you know you have no cam lean. I mean, that's a good telltale factor that something's up with your grip, and it's twisting the bow one way or the other. So your string's kind of coming off at an angle. And a lot of times that'll show through paper. Say you got your center shot set up, everything's dead on, but you're still getting a little bit of tear on there, and you kind of notice that your grip's kind of twisted one way or the other. I mean, that's probably going to be the factor that's throwing off your shots and not giving you a good arrow flight.
Okay. Now, I had a guy tell me once that paper tuning is pointless because he felt that it's okay if the arrow's a little sporadic right out of the gate, as long as it's not sporadic all the way down range, right? So would you agree or disagree with that?
I guess depends on the scenario. And a lot of guys, I listened to a few guys that used to shoot target archery back in the 70s and 80s that come into the bow shop, and they said they used to set up their bows so they were, actually the arrow was coming out a little bit sideways or crooked, if that makes sense. So they were getting either a left or right tear in paper, and they wanted that just so their arrow would correct the same exact way every time. But now it kind of seems the trend is getting your arrow to come off plumb exact every single time. Mm-hmm. Just kind of takes another factor out of it. Because once you throw outdoor elements into that, like wind especially, you kind of have to even throw a little more guesswork into the mix when your arrow's not coming off exactly plumb and exactly straight every time, versus having it come off crooked and maybe the wind's going to throw something weird into effect since your arrow's not coming off perfect.
Right. Okay. Now I want to go back to the grip for a second. Mm-hmm. What does having a big fat grip and then some guys like the really skinny ones, what do those accomplish?
This is another one of those things that comes down to personal preference. Some professional archers you'll see have a lot of like tennis wrap or something on that on their grip, so it kind of builds up a lot of kind of fatness around there, and it's more circular than kind of a square. And they're just kind of that's just kind of how they like to have their hands sitting there. That's kind of their way to take the torque out of it. Whereas some people, they'll shoot plain off the riser, where there's, you know, no wood or rubber grip on there, and they just kind of like how that feels on there. They feel like that thin grip is easier to take the torque out of, and a lot of times that'll give you feedback too on the shots, like vibration and stuff. And I mean, it's just, that's kind of how I shoot mine. I like kind of a smaller grip. I typically don't put a lot of either tennis wrap material or tape on there. I'll either leave the stock grip or just shoot off the riser. And I just kind of feel like that thinner grip is easier for me with smaller hands anyways, to get my grip the same exact every time with my hand type and take as much torque out of the shot as I can.
So you like a smaller or bigger? What'd you say?
I like a thinner grip, smaller.
A thinner grip. Okay. So you feel that a thinner grip helps prevent torque?
Yeah. For my shots anyways.
For your shot. Yeah. Okay. All right. Now, anything else? We're coming up on time here, but anything else from a form standpoint that you see a lot of no-nos, or you feel that if someone simply did this, that it would be a better, they'd have better form?
I guess a big thing that a lot of people don't do is record their shots. You know, either have a buddy or just set up your phone or camera or something on a tripod and watch yourself shoot, because you'll see a lot of things that you don't even know you're doing, whether that be punching the trigger, maybe your draw length looks a little too long and you didn't know it, or your front arm, you feel like it's, you know, straight and has that little bit of bend on it, but really it's bent, you know, quite a bit, or it's perfectly straight. And I mean, just getting a different view on yourself will show you a different angle, and and probably bring out a few things you didn't realize you were even doing.
Gotcha. What about, like, where should your feet be? What should your back be doing? Anything like that?
For stance, I like to, I'll start perfectly perpendicular to the target, and then I'll open my front foot, slide it back probably an inch or two behind my rear foot, and then kind of open it up. And then I kind of follow John Dudley's form, what he tells you. And that's to kind of make a T with your body, where your back's perfectly in line with your legs, and kind of make a T. And then once you pick your bow up, your arm should be straight out. And I mean, if you take a picture of it, your body kind of looks perfectly like a T.
I gotcha. Okay, cool. And does that same principle apply from a guy who's on a tiny platform tree stand?
Should be. I mean, it'll look a little bit different once you're shooting at angles and stuff. And I mean, the biggest thing you do shooting at angles, a lot of guys are going to try and bend with their back, which will kind of throw your form off a little bit, whether that be your anchor point, or your front arm will change a little bit in shoulder position.
Yeah.
But what you want to do as far as that is bending at your hip will kind of keep that posture and keep your anchor point the same.
Okay. Cool. Well, we've been talking for about an hour now, and like I always say about this time, I can start hearing my kids yelling and screaming in the next room over, which tells me it's time for them to brush their teeth and go to bed, which tells me that it is time to end this podcast. But David, man, I want to say thanks for the insight. I learned a lot today, and thanks for coming on the podcast, man.
Yeah, no problem, Dan. Thanks for having me on today.
And there you have it. Huge shout out to David for coming on the podcast and talking archery knowledge with us today. Really appreciate your time, and good luck with finals, I guess, that are coming up. Anyway, huge shout out to each and every one of you who have taken the time to download this episode and give it a listen. I made a couple changes to the format and editing that I do on this podcast, and hopefully you can hear that. Hopefully the sound quality is just a little bit better, and the flow is just a little bit better. I can always use some advice, so if you hear something wrong, be sure to get a hold of me. Also, the partners of this podcast that make it all possible: Deer Lab, Lone Wolf, Gearhead, Wasp, Ozonix, Ripcord, and Exodus Trail Cameras. Be sure to go and visit their websites, take a look at their products, and remember, the couple of these products and companies are giving specific, I guess, discounts to only the listeners of this podcast. So be sure to listen to each and every podcast, because there are a handful of great deals that you won't find anywhere else out there. Also, follow me on Facebook, follow me on Twitter, follow me on Instagram. And if you guys want to be on the podcast because of a big buck that you killed, or a buck, or an elk, or a sheep, or any type of animal, I want to, you know, my goal is not just whitetails. It's all hunting, bow hunting type of themes. If you want to do a product review, if you want to do a bow review, any type of review on any type of product, I'm down for that. If you are listening to this podcast and you are the owner of a company and you want to come on this podcast, send me a message on Facebook, or you guys can email me at ninefingerchronicles@gmail.com. I think that's about it. As always, go check out the National Deer Alliance. Sign up. It's free. Become a member and become educated. Other than that, if you're going to be in a tree, hang in a tree stand, or doing any type of work, be safe and wear your damn safety harness. Have a good weekend. Thank you.
Thank you.